Our vacation Bible school this year has been themed Discovering Bible Lands. And each of the classes has been centered around a particular geographical location and the significance that it had to particular Bible stories. The first night in here, we talked about Egypt. And, you know, as we've mentioned, we're not looking at these places a lot in an archaeological kind of way and looking at the various geographical boundaries and unique features of these places, but trying to learn some Bible lessons from the stories that are centered around them. So we tried to do a study of discovering deliverance from what we learned in Egypt, and that was our first night. Second night, we were in Jericho and talked about discovering obedience from the story about Jericho in Joshua chapter 6. And last night, we went into Galilee, and we didn't finish our study of Galilee last night, so we're doing part two tonight and going to try to finish it up. But the focus of the study of Galilee is discovering faith in Galilee. And just a reminder for those who are not here, and in case we need a reminder, as to where Galilee is, just in a geographical sense. It's up in the northern part of what we look at as Palestine. Down here is Judea with the city of Jerusalem. But it's this region up here that's close to the Sea of Galilee with a number of cities that, if we've read through the gospel accounts of the life of Christ, that a number of cities that would be familiar to us in their names. And so we're going to a few of those cities as a part of this study. But what we're trying to do is discover what can we learn about faith from just going to the region of Galilee. There's four times in the life of Christ, as we have it, that Jesus said to some individuals, "O you of little faith." Four times he said it. Every time that he said that, he was in the region of Galilee. Every time he said that, he's not saying that to some individuals who had never heard about him. He's not saying that to some outsiders who had no understanding of who Jesus was. He's saying it to his disciples. And obviously, there was something behind it. You know, Jesus doesn't just use words randomly. There was a purpose behind this. But four times, he looks at his followers and says, "Oh, you of little faith." Well, why did he say that? And so what we've tried to do is say, let's look at these four accounts, say, what can we learn about faith? What can we discover about faith from them? And last night, we only got through two. So hopefully, we're going to get through the other two tonight. And if we do, there's going to be a couple bonuses for us to look at the end. And I hope we have time for them because they're kind of fun, too. But last night, we looked at the first two. We looked at Matthew chapter 6, where we see that sometimes worry leads to little faith. But sometimes it's little faith that leads to worry, and the two go hand in hand. So the context in Matthew 6, when Jesus says, "Oh, you of little faith," the context there is about worry and how worry can lead us to have little faith and vice versa. Then we went to Matthew chapter 8, where Jesus, after a long day of doing a number of miracles, was in the boat with his disciples in the Sea of Galilee, and a storm came up that they were all concerned about. Jesus was asleep in the boat, and they came and woke him up and said, "Lord, save us, we are perishing." Jesus awoke, he stilled the storm, and what did he say? "Why were you fearful? Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?" And so we talked about how fear can lead to little faith. And sometimes little faith can lead to fear, and it goes both ways. But we tried to look at how can I overcome worry to have a greater faith? How can I overcome fear to have a greater faith? So we're going to move on tonight to the third instance. And all four of these are not only in Galilee, all four of these are mentioned in the book of Matthew. So we're kind of parked in the book of Matthew for this study. We were in Matthew 6 for the first one, Matthew 8 for the second one. We're in Matthew chapter 14 for the third one. And probably one of the most familiar New Testament stories to you is in Matthew chapter 14. And what we're going to be looking at is how doubt can lead to little faith, or sometimes little faith can lead to doubt. And where we're seeing the verse in particular where this expression is found is in verse 31. Matthew 14, verse 31, where the Bible says, "Immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said, 'O you of little faith, why did you doubt?'" I find it interesting that these first three times that Jesus says, "Oh, you have little faith," he gives right there in the statement what was causing their little faith. Matthew 6, what's causing their little faith? Worry. Matthew 8, what's causing their little faith? Fear. Matthew 14, what's causing his little faith or their little faith? Doubt. Doubt is detrimental to us having a strong faith. The Greek word that's used here, there's a couple different Greek words, but the Greek word that's used here in this passage for the word doubt means to pull in two directions, to pull in two ways. It's a compound word that literally means double standing, where I'm standing, but I'm standing in two different directions. Is that descriptive for us of what doubt is? That I want to go this way, but what's doubt doing? It's pulling me over there where I'm not trying to go because I'm not really sure. I'm going to go this way, but wait a minute. Maybe that's the way I should go. No, I'm going to go this way, but what's still lingering here? Oh, man, maybe that's the way. And we start getting pulled. What sort of things do we doubt? When we talk about doubt, what sorts of things do we doubt? Where does this come into our lives? This is where there's a long pause after a question, and you have an opportunity to contribute to the discussion. What as a Christian? I'm not talking about, do you doubt that Georgia's going to, go back to the national championship game or not? I mean, I'm not talking about those kind of doubts. I'm talking about as a Christian. What sort of things do we struggle with? And I'll ask it this way, the way we asked it last night. I'm not asking what you doubt, okay, because I know you don't doubt anything as a Christian. So we're just talking in general terms tonight about, other Christians who have doubts. What would they be? So we're talking about other people that aren't in this room. Isn't that a nice thing to do? So we're just going to talk about people. What sort of things would they doubt, Christians? Okay. Maybe as a Christian we doubt sometimes. Is there a God? Can't see Him. What else? Doubt that I really need to be baptized? Tina? Okay. Doubt that am I really going to go to heaven? I'm just not really sure. I doubt that. Bonnie? Right. So there's a lot of things. What else? Say that again. Yes. That we have questions that have been unanswered, and that can sometimes lead to doubts. Who had Mary? Was your hand up? Doubt that he's going to answer our prayers. We might even doubt that he even hears our prayers. Are we sure he's even listening? Might doubt that our sins are forgiven. So, Christopher. Okay, am I good enough? Am I a good Christian? Am I living the way I should? Sounds like you've talked to a lot of other people who have some... Jimmy? Jimmy, what did you say? Okay. Are we really working for him, Carolyn?
Is Jesus really God?
Okay. Talking about who is Jesus. And so, okay, so there's a lot of things that perhaps as Christians we have doubts about. Are doubts bad? Are doubts wrong? I want you to let that sit for a minute. Think about that. Is it possible sometimes that doubts can become little seeds that we allow to get planted into our minds, into our hearts, into our souls, and let them sit there, and let them just start to grow a little bit? If we have doubts, do we need to deal with them? Do we need to address them or just, let them go? So here's Jesus. Now, you know the context here, right? I mean, we just read the one verse. We're going to expand and look at the context. But you know the context here. He's talking to little faith. He's talking to Peter, right? He's talking to Peter, one who had, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Did Peter have doubts? Well, obviously, because Jesus said that to him. Is it wrong for us to doubt? What's interesting is we talked about worry and fear last night, and we saw that worry is forbidden. Jesus says, do not worry. We looked at fear, and fear is forbidden. God tells us, do not fear. What about doubt? Does God tell us not to doubt? Well, in James chapter 1 and verse 6, let him ask in faith without or with no doubting. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5, trust in the Lord with all of your heart and lean not on your own understanding. Would doubts fit within the realm of leaning on your own understanding as opposed to trusting in the Lord? So I put that on the screen. I guess I forgot to put Proverbs 3 there. But something to think about, should we allow doubts to just live within our hearts, or should we try to get rid of those? God says, trust in the Lord with... See, that little word all there says, I've got to deal with things that come into my life that are going to lead me to not trust in Him with all of my heart. Now, sometimes are there questions that don't have answers? Are there questions sometimes that don't have answers? Deuteronomy 29 and verse 29 says what? There are some secret things that belong to God, not to me. Are there some things about God, about Jesus, about the world, about creation, about heaven, about all sorts of things that I don't have all of the answers? Is that true? Is that possible? Sure. Now, don't mishear me, okay? Do I have all of the answers that I need? Ah, that's a different question. I may not have all of the information that I want, but in this book, I've got all of the answers and all of the information that I need. And so if I come back here, I can plant my feet upon this book and say, I can have confidence in this book. Can I have confidence? This is back, taking a few steps back. Can I have confidence that the Bible is inspired of God? Or is that just an idea that somebody came up with? If you tonight do not have absolute, firm, bedrock confidence that this book is 100% inspired of God, would you come up and talk to me after class tonight? And if not that, would you research that tonight? Would you look on our website and study it? Would you go to apologeticspress.org and study it? Would you allow me to give you a track or a book on it and study it? Not to brainwash you, but for you to examine the evidence and to see that there's not just a little evidence, that the evidence is overwhelming to prove. And so what that says is, if I can know, not just hope, if I can know that this book is 100% inspired of God, then when I come to it, what is it? It is the basis of all faith that I have, which will help, hopefully, to remove some doubts from my life. What's doubt going to do to me? Let's look at this passage. We're not going to dissect it entirely. But look at this passage, and you know it. You've studied it. You've read it. It's one of your favorite stories, I know. Matthew chapter 14. Jesus comes walking to them on the water. And he, you know, the whole thing transpires where he comes walking and they think he's a ghost. And he says, obviously I'm not a ghost. Be of good cheer. It's I. Do not be afraid. And Peter says, Lord, if it's you, bid me to come to you out on the water. And Jesus says, come. And so Peter gets out of the boat and he walks on the water to go to Jesus. He looks around, sees the wind and the waves. He begins to sink and he says, Lord, save me. And immediately stretches his hand out. Oh, you have little faith. Why did you doubt? That's the story in 20 seconds, and now Kathy's not very happy with me. But can doubt do... What does doubt do to me? Just a few things from this story. Doubt will cause me to fail to reach my destination. Where was Peter going when he got out of the boat? The Bible says he was going to Jesus. Did he get there? Nope. What got in his way?
Doubt.
Do I have a destination that I'm trying to reach? Can doubt keep me from getting there? That's one thing that doubt can do. It can cause me to not get to my destination. Doubt can cause me to focus on my problems rather than on the Lord. What does verse 28 say? By the way, first word I've got, or not verse 28, verse 30. First word I've got in verse 30 is the word but. But when he saw, and it doesn't say when he saw the Lord. It says when he saw that the wind was boisterous. Can you see wind? Ah, you can't see the wind. You can see what the wind's doing. How would he be able to see what the wind was doing? You know the answer to that. He had to take his focus off of the Lord and start putting it somewhere else. Will doubt do that? Doubt will take our focus away from the Lord, and it's going to start putting it on our problems. Does that sound like a good thing for us to have in our lives? It's going to cause me to fall short of where I want to go, and it's going to take my focus off. Do you know that to be true in your own life? You start doubting things, and all of a sudden you start raising questions in your mind that lead to other questions, that lead to other questions, and all of a sudden you've just got this swirl of doubt in your mind and in your heart. Are you looking at the Lord anymore? You're off in this other world that you've created that's just full of doubt. Turn over to James chapter 1. Hold your finger in Matthew 14. But go over to James chapter 1. I think what we see in these first few verses of James chapter 1 are telling for us. James chapter 1. We've got a couple verses here that talk to us about the effects of doubt and what doubt does to us. Look in James chapter 1 and verse 6. Let him ask in faith with no doubting. Why not? It's almost like James was thinking about Matthew 14. Because how does he describe doubt? He who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven by the wind and tossed. Is that what doubt does to us? It throws us around. It says, okay, focus on the cares of life and just let that bounce you around in what you're doing. Doubt causes me, verse 8, he is a double-minded man. Remember the definition of doubt? I'm pulled in two different directions. Well, that means I'm double-minded. And when I'm double-minded, what does this verse say in verse 8? I'm unstable. If I am full of doubt, where's my stability? I'm not stable. I'm bouncing around and I'm unstable in all of my ways. Verse 7 says, let not that man suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. Ooh, that gets really sharp. Well, why am I not going to receive anything from the Lord? Because I'm doubting. Go back up to verse 6. Let him ask in faith. Can I have faith and doubt at the same time? Can I have trust in the Lord with all of my heart and lean on my own understanding at the same time? I can't have them at the same time. I've got to pick one. And doubt gets in the way of me having my faith in God. Somebody says, yeah, but what about these questions? Well, are there answers to the questions? That's what you got to find out. The questions that you have, is there a Bible answer to them? And if there is, let's find that Bible answer and let the Bible answer it. And then we've got to be satisfied with the Bible answer. Sometimes we're not. Yeah, but. Oh, yeah, but. Oh, I see what that's saying, but. No. If there's a Bible answer for it, I've got to take the Bible answer. I've got to be satisfied with the Bible answer. But what if I've got a question about what color eyes does a Martian have? And I'm just not sure that I want to go to heaven if I'm just can't figure out what color eyes a Martian has. Carolyn says, you don't need to go then. Well, you know, I don't. If you've got these questions, if there's a Bible answer to them, let's find it and nail it down. But if you've got these things that are bugging you, that are leading to doubts, and are these seeds that are being planted that are causing you to be unstable, that are causing you to say, yeah, I want to serve the Lord, but oh, I don't know about this over here. If this is not something the Lord has seen fit to say, you need this answer, and we don't need to worry about it, to go back to last night, and we don't need to have our hearts full of doubt as to why the Lord has not chosen to reveal these things to us. So, what can I do? Jesus says, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? What can I do to have a faith that will overcome doubts? Come back to Matthew 14. Hold your finger in James 1. I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. But come back to this story, Matthew 14. And let's see just from this story if I can learn some things about how can I have a faith that will overcome doubts. First of all, I need to expect that God knows what I'm going through. That Jesus knows what I'm going through. How can I have a faith that overcomes doubt? I need to absolutely believe that the Lord knows what troubles I'm in. Where was Jesus before this whole event started with the boat in the middle of the Sea of Galilee and the storm and all that? Where was Jesus? He's up on a mountain by himself. That's where he wanted to be. Was up on a mountain by himself praying. Did that mean that he was totally blind to what was happening to his disciples? No. We don't have time tonight to do it, but it is one of my favorite things to look at all of the passages that discuss, all of the parallel passages that discuss this story. To look in Mark 6, John 6, and Matthew 14, the three accounts of this, to pull them all together. And it's so cool to see that it was the middle of the night. What does that mean? It's dark. There is a storm going on. What does that mean? Visibility is not very good. It is in what? Well, it tells us right here in verse 25. It's in the fourth watch of the night. So it's not like 10 or 11 or 12 o'clock at night. It is between 3 and 6 a.m. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. When is it darkest? Right before? So here's the darkest part. Here is in the middle of a storm, fourth watch of the night. Jesus is up on the mountain. John, I think it's John's account, John chapter 6, it says, they had rowed out into, well, this tells us they're in the middle of the sea. John says they had rowed 3 or 4 miles out. And the Bible says that Jesus saw them straining at rowing. You want to have a faith that overcomes doubt? If Jesus could see them and what their troubles they were going through, what about me? Can he see what troubles I'm going through? And I look at it and I say, yeah, but why hasn't he done something about it? Does he know about it? Does he care about it? And that needs to help me to have a faith that's going to overcome these doubts. Second thing is that he sees, he's there to help anytime and anywhere. And again, it's the middle of the night. They're out in the middle of the sea. But that didn't change things. Jesus didn't say, man, they're just so far out there. I wish they hadn't gone that far. I can't get that far. Doesn't matter time. Doesn't matter place. Jesus is there for us no matter what. You want a faith that overcomes doubt? We need to expect that there's nothing too hard for the Lord. What did he do? He went to them walking on the water. Hello. How was he going to get there? I mean, it would have looked really silly if he came to them in a helicopter, wouldn't it? Because they'd be like, they wouldn't be concerned about a ghost. You know, they'd be saying, UFO. You know, they'd be all freaked out. Could he have gone to them in a helicopter? Well, that wouldn't have been the best deal. Could he have floated out there? He's a human being. He could have done all number of things, but nothing was too hard for him. I'll just go walk on the water. Is that hard for you? But nothing's too hard for him. You want a faith that's going to overcome doubt? Take comfort and delight and assurance in the presence of the Lord. They were afraid. I like what verse 27 says. Verse 26 says they cried out for fear. Verse 27 says, Jesus waited a few minutes and was laughing at them because they were scaredy cats. And then he said, is that the way your verse reads? Don't you like the word immediately in that verse? Here they are afraid, and what does the verse say? Immediately Jesus spoke to them, be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid. We need to have absolute assurance that the Lord is present with us, even in the midst of our trials and the difficulties of our life. Number whatever next this is, we need to expect that God's help, that with God's help, great things can be done. Peter got out of the boat, and he walked on water. Is that pretty cool? With God, was he doing that by himself? Oh, he's doing that with Jesus' help. I mean, he's not going to do that on his own. And I'm not saying we can walk on water, but with God's help, can we do great things? We need to have a faith that doesn't allow doubt to creep into our hearts, but to know the Lord is there, the Lord can do anything in my life. He knows the troubles that I'm in, and He is able to help me to do great things. Obviously, you mentioned this. Number six, I think, we need to keep our eyes on the Lord. And if we will keep our eyes on Him and not allow ourselves to be distracted by the things of this life, and we need to know that the Lord is near. He's not just with us. He's not just in the room, that He is near. When Peter began to sink in verse 30 and said, Lord, save me, you got this same word we saw in verse 27, now in verse 31. Immediately, Jesus stretched out His hand. It does not say that Jesus had to sprint over to where He was. It doesn't say that. It says how close? Jesus isn't, He doesn't have the Gumby arms that we see in the movies, that He's just, and it's not go-go gadget arms or any of that business. He's a human being. Where was Jesus when Peter was sinking? Right. That close enough to reach out and touch Him. We need to have confidence. That's where God is. We don't need, and somebody says, well, I can't see Him. Okay. Do you believe that He's there? Do you trust Him? When He says, I will never leave you nor forsake you, you absolutely have full confidence that He is, and not doubt that for a moment. And this whole story, while you might think of Peter and Jesus walking on the water as a children's story, children get this much of this story. You get older and you get the whole package. And we need to allow that to build our faith. If we were to go back to James, and we're not going to get through all of this tonight, are we? If we were to go back to James, if I want a faith that's going to overcome doubt, then I need to pray for wisdom, James 1 and verse 5. And when I pray, I need to pray in faith. And I need to have absolute confidence and faith that my God is there for me. I need to have confidence in His presence, in His power. I need to have absolute confidence that whatever He has said, He's gonna come through on it. Yes. Good. Okay. Good question. So if God knows all of our troubles and the things that bother us and concern us, question is, does the devil know those things? Does the devil? If God is all knowing, is the devil all knowing? Is there a verse that would indicate that He is? No. He's not all knowing, and He's not all powerful. And He's not all everywhere either. We think about God being the omni-God, the omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent God. Those are qualities that only are possessed by deity. Do we hear that? They're only possessed by deity. Is Satan deity? No. No, 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 no. So He does not possess any of those qualities. So how does He know what to do to tempt us? Trial and error. Does that work?
Go
ahead, Diane. He's opportunistic, that's for sure. He is walking about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. But as powerful as we think that he is, who's more powerful? Here's the way you're going to answer that. You're going to say God's more powerful than him. Absolutely right. Who's more powerful than him? I took God off. I already gave you God. I already gave you that answer. Who's more powerful than him? We are. We are more powerful than the devil. What? How do you figure that? The verse in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8 that says, "Be sober, be vigilant, for your adversary, the devil, walks about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Do you know what verse 9 starts with? These two words. Resist him. And it's not a capital H, by the way, on him. Okay? It's resist him. Can we do that? What does that indicate? I can say no to him. But where does that power come from? 1 John 4 and verse 4, "He that is within us is greater than he that is in the world." Do I have the ability to overcome the devil? Resist him steadfastly, that verse continues, in the faith. Power is not within me. The power is within me and the Word of God and the power of God in me to do that. I want you to put all of that together in what we've talked about. That the power is not within me, that the power is within God and His Word abiding in me. That's why David would say, "Thy Word I have hid in my heart that I may not sin against you." Well, what's sin? Sin is when I give in to a temptation. Who's tempting? Well, the evil one. How can I resist that? I get God inside of me. I get His Word inside of me. And I'm able to resist that. But what else do we need to say about doubt tonight? Okay. All right. So it's like electricity with the positive and negative side, Scott says. Sure. Anybody else? We're talking about a lot of stuff here tonight. I'll let you make some comments if you want to make any comments based on what we're saying here. And there was silence. Yes, sir. Dirk says best way to overcome doubt is to look backwards. That is an excellent segue, Dirk, into fourth time that Jesus says, "Oh, you of little faith." Because when we get over to Matthew 16, I'm serious, perfect segue. You get over to Matthew 16, it's the fourth time, and we're going to run through this. We don't have time to develop all of this. Fourth time Jesus says, Matthew 16 and verse 8, "O you of little faith." But he says to them, "O you of little faith," in the context of, he had just said to them, and I'll put all of this stuff up here, and I don't know what order we're going to talk about it, but I'll just put it here anyway. He says this in the context of, he says to them in Matthew 16 verses 5 and 6, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." And the disciples, well, they got concerned. And they said, "Oh no, he's saying that because we forgot to bring bread." And that's when Jesus says, Matthew 16 and verse 8, after they're over there saying, "Oh no," verse 6, "we forgot to bring," verse 7, "it's because we have taken no bread," that he's saying this. Verse 8, Jesus says, "Oh, you have little faith. Why do you discuss among yourselves? Why do you reason among yourselves? Because you have brought no bread." Was Jesus, when Jesus said, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees," was he talking about bread? Was he talking about, you know, the what you would eat? No. And you get that down in verse 12, that he's talking to them about their doctrine and how leaven was a poison in their doctrine that was spreading like leaven does and influencing individuals. But Jesus takes this occasion to say, "You've got little faith," and there's a number of things I could have put on here, but I centered it on this idea of forgetting, which goes right to Dirk's point. What does Jesus say? "You've got little faith. Why do you have little faith?" Well, not just because they think he's talking about bread and not the doctrine of the Pharisees. "You've got little faith because why would you be concerned about whether we've got bread or not?" So in the next two verses, what does he say? And it's interesting, if you compare Mark's, if you compare the Gospel of Mark and the parallel over in Mark, I think it's in Mark chapter 8, but it's interesting, in Mark's account, you have this where he's asking the question and they give the answer. And so he asks the question, when I fed the 5,000, how many baskets did we take up? And they said, 12. He said, okay, when I just fed the 4,000 in the last chapter, when I just fed the 4,000, how many baskets would I take up? And they said, 7. What's Jesus' point? Why are you concerned about whether you bought bread or not? Hello? Did you forget already? I'm the Lord of heaven and earth. I'm the Lord of bread. And if we need bread, I'm going to take care of that. So it's interesting in this context that he's saying, oh, you of little faith. And we could talk here about human reasoning and that they weren't reasoning correctly. But what Jesus is pinpointing here is that they've got a little faith. Don't misunderstand the idea of forgetting. I mean, all of us are forgetful, right? That's why this doesn't say forgetful, all right? And it's not saying that, you know, if you forget to pick up your kids at school that you've got little faith. You know, it's not saying if you forget where your keys are, you've got little faith. We're not talking about that. Talking about exactly what Dirk mentioned. How do I overcome doubt is what Dirk was talking about. I need to look in the rearview mirror. How do I have a stronger faith? I remember. And that's what Jesus is saying. Where's the word remember here? Somewhere in the context of Matthew chapter 16, where he uses the word remember to say, if you would remember what I had done, where would your faith be? Same thing for us. What would happen if we would spend time remembering what the Lord has done for us? Sometimes we get so fixed on what's going on in our lives right now that we forget. We forget what's happened in our past. You know, sometimes you can't always put a finger on when the providence of God is working in our lives. You can't always put a finger on that. Remember how it was worded to Esther that you may have been brought to the kingdom for such a time as it. We're not really sure, but it could be, because it's hard to put a finger on providence of God at the time. But have you lived long enough to be able to look in the rearview mirror and to say, God was at work in my life? Jesus is saying to these individuals, you've got little faith because you're not spending enough time remembering what I've done. You want to build our faith? Increase our faith? What has God done? Now, we can look just in the immediate past. We can look, you know, in the last few decades, or we can go back 2,000 years and remember what the Lord has done for me. Will that build my faith? Did Jesus die just for those people in his lifetime? Did he just die for his apostles? Or was he looking on down through time and saying, I'm doing this for Jeff. I'm doing this for Bill. I'm doing this for Ophelia. I'm doing this for every single one of us. That ought to build our faith.
I think he knew we'd forget, because I like that we meet every first day of the week. He knows, like, within a week we might forget.
Why is it that not the Church of Christ, but Christ is the one who instituted the Lord's Supper and instituted it to be done on a weekly basis? Why did he do that? Because as he was passing out the emblems, he said, do this in remembrance of me. What did he know that we needed? Reminders. And so we have a weekly time to reflect and to remember what the Lord has done for us. And that ought to build our faith, to increase our faith, to overcome worry, to overcome fear, to overcome doubt, and overcome forgetting the more that we're able to remember. That's the fourth time, and I didn't want to spend a lot of time there, but that's the fourth time Jesus says, oh, you of little faith. Let me very quickly just drop a couple little nuggets for us to consider. Four times Jesus said, "Oh, you of little faith." And so you would think, boy, Jesus just went around criticizing people who had a lack of faith. Boy, that's great. You know, you got Jesus and all he does is just nail people for having little faith. Did Jesus ever compliment? Did Jesus ever hold individuals up? Did Jesus ever say to somebody, "You know, you've got great faith"? Here's the interesting thing. Number one, every time he said, "Oh, you of little faith," it was to his followers. But when he said, "Oh, you of great faith," it was to a Gentile. Isn't that interesting? Second thing I think that's interesting is that all four times he said, "Oh, you of little faith," was in Galilee. The two times, at least in the book of Matthew, that we're going to look at just in 3 minutes, two times he said, essentially, "Oh, you of great faith." One of them was in Galilee. The other was north of Galilee, up in what we would call what was called Phoenicia, but it's a northern district just above Galilee. But again, not in Jerusalem. He did not say, "Here's somebody in Jerusalem. Boy, you've got more faith than anybody I've met." It was to these outsiders, to the Gentiles. So very quickly, let me just mention these. Matthew chapter 8. We read about. Well, let me put it back up there. We read about the centurion who comes to Jesus. We read about the centurion who comes to Jesus and he wants his servant to be healed. A Roman centurion comes to Jesus and he wants his servant to be healed. So what does he do? He calls upon Jesus and he falls down before him. And when Jesus says, "Fine, I'm going to come to your house," he says, "I'm not worthy for you to come to my house." He comes to Jesus, and he knows that he's his only hope. He comes to Jesus, he says, "I'm not worthy for you to come to my house." He comes to Jesus and acknowledges, he says, I'm like you. I've got people that are under me." He recognizes he's got one who has supreme authority. How many people in Jerusalem did those three things? Not very many. And so Jesus says to him in Matthew chapter 8, down in... what verse does he say this? Verse 10 of Matthew chapter 8. "Surely I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel." Haven't found it. "Among the Jews, I haven't seen this kind of faith." But here's this outsider who's got that kind of faith. And in the last minute, go to Matthew chapter 15. Last minute, go to Matthew chapter 15. And the second time we're going to see this is now it's not a man, but it's a woman. And it's this woman from Phoenicia who comes to him. And she has a daughter who is severely demon-possessed. She comes before Jesus and the disciples don't want anything to do with her. But she is incessant. She doesn't just cry out once and the disciples send her away. But she cries out incessantly, "Have mercy, have mercy, have mercy on me, on my daughter." She has cried. Why? Jesus is her only hope. She falls down before him and worships him at his feet in verse 25. And Jesus says to her, "It is not good," verse 26, "to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs." He's not in trying to insult her, but that's the way the Jews looked at the Gentiles, as the dogs. And what does she do? She says, "If I've got to be a little dog, I'll be a little dog. Please heal my daughter." She had absolute confidence that Jesus was the only one who could help her. And so he says to her in verse 28, "O woman, great is your faith." Two individuals who were not Jews, two individuals who were outsiders, two individuals who absolutely understood that Jesus was their only hope. Can we have that kind of faith? I think we can learn from those who had little faith, and we can say, "I'm sort of like that. I've got doubts sometimes, I got fears sometimes, I got worries sometimes, I've got forgetting sometimes what the Lord's done for me. I need greater faith so those four things don't defeat me." How can I have greater faith? Have greater faith, I need to put my confidence in Jesus more than anybody else does, and more than I ever have. And know that He is my only hope.